Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
The United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden.
3 U.S. helicopters.
4 U.S. military helicopters.
You see the 2 helicopters coming in?
Yes. Let me stop.
The narrative was a discrepancy.
I apologize. Yeah.
40 members of Navy SEAL Team 6 took bin Laden's compound.
As dozens of U.S. commandos set up a perimeter.
He was not armed, is what I understand to be true.
They killed Osama bin Laden and took custody of his body.
Osama bin Laden had a code name, Geronimo.
A U.S. official says bin Laden was called Jackpot.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
I asked Michelle the other day, I said, what's your favorite food? Because we were sitting around with the girls. She said, oh, Mexican food. You do not want to be between Michelle and tamale. That is true. You know, but she's moving, though, so she can afford to have as many tamales as she wants.
Right, you eat carrots. Let them eat carrots. Let them eat carrots. Let them eat carrots. Let them eat carrot sticks. Welcome to the Savage Nation. It's a weird Friday. It's a weird Friday. I'm brain dead from this week. It's enough already with punting the football and glorifying himself. I mean, I'm glad the SEALs killed them, you know? Al-Qaeda even acknowledged that they really did kill him. He hasn't been, you know, dead for 10 years, so that's good. And the evidence at bin Laden's home raises nuclear concerns, no doubt related to the Pakistani government itself, which is a problem. It's a nuclear power. You know, who knows what could happen tomorrow now to get even with us for doing our job finally. I don't know how Obama let Hillary Clinton get away with this. Looked to me like Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta should take the credit for this bold action to bail him out of the stew. But let's make it an open mic to Mike Friday, 1-800-449-8255. Because, frankly, at this point, I can't focus on the news. I cannot do it. I just can't do it. I can't. I'm gagging on it. I'm gagging on the news. I mean, are you mad at me that I can't focus on this? He congratulates the SEAL team today. How about the wild monkeys in Hong Kong who are getting birth control? You know, that's an interesting story unto itself. Can we have clip 21? Let's set it up for the people. They don't realize monkeys have gone hog wild in Hong Kong. Let's hear this.
Hong Kong is a thriving concrete and glass metropolis of 7 million people. It's cramped.
All Democrat. Potential
but
Democratic
wild
voters.
Monkeys are at home in this concrete jungle and thrive on the fringes of its teeming streets.
Mm-hmm. So apparently the monkeys are out of control in Hong Kong because people are giving them human food. And the monkeys are now getting wild and they're chasing people, grabbing supermarket bags. And so they're actually giving them birth control. Listen to clip 23.
Monkeys have done so well that the government has introduced contraceptives to curb a population boom. Today, these macaques are sedated and then permanently sterilized.
This program is trying to slow down
some Irish food, man. Just give them corned beef and cabbage. They'll disappear within one generation.
Better for the living in our countryside area.
Why do these animal rights people, who I generally like, I mean, you got to have people like this protecting the wildlife. Why do they sound so bad? So would you rather talk about the wild monkeys in Hong Kong or bin Laden, London, they're threatening to overthrow the entire British government and impose Sharia law, saying Islam will win. They aren't kicked out, though, the radicals in London. I'm not allowed in, but those who are threatening to overthrow the country and kill the leadership of England, they're not only allowed in, they're citizens. You hear this? So who's running England is the question. It certainly couldn't be the pub sluts. I mean, the pub sluts aren't running England anymore, puking on themselves and winding up in a gutter in the morning. Pardon me for being so airborne, spiking the football all week long. I'm not going to spike the football. I'm not going to show the picture. And there he is spiking the football. Is he the first one to actually show the seals? Because he went to the seal. Oh, no, that wasn't just the seals. Okay. Oh, look, he's got to do a victory run. He never had it so good. He's enjoying himself. This is good. And, you know, to his credit, to be honest with you, to Obama's credit, at least he didn't wear a bomber jacket like Clinton did and the others. At least he had the decency not to put on a military garb. That I liked. That showed class. I got to tell you, you know, when he's right, he's right. It's true all of his social policies have failed. All of his economic policies have failed. But, you know, you got to give credit where credit is due. And I know this is all you want to talk about. No matter what I say, no matter what I do, no matter what I bring up, you're only going to come back to this. There's no way around it. There's just no way around it. It's all you want to talk about. And it is Rock and Roll Friday. And we can talk about Obama's Cinco de Mayo White House remarks. Again, let's listen to clip 10. Maybe that'll get your interest going. Let's listen to it.
Gracias. Buenas noches. Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Cinco de Mayo at the White House.
Yeah. Now let's hear 12. 12, 12, 12, 12.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is in the house. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis is here. Several members of Congress have made the trek tonight. And everybody, please join me in wishing a feliz cumpleaños to the chairman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Charlie Gonzalez.
You know, frankly, it makes me sick to listen to this. I am so sick of ethnic caucuses. How about a Congressional American Caucus? That would work for me. But this man has thrived on dividing one group against another. You understand the Democrat Party is the minority party, number one. Number two, the Democrat Party, especially the leftist Democrat Party under Obama, thrives on pitting one group against another. And frankly, it's nauseating to hear about congressional, you know, minority caucuses. There's no place for that in a pluralistic nation such as ours. So I'm going to take your calls in a minute on the Savage Nation. Please, let's not bash Obama. He does a good enough job of himself virtually on a daily basis. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. It's the Rock and Roll Friday, by the way. Can we have some rock and roll? How about any of my favorites? I can't even call for one. Do I have? Hold on, guy. Go ahead, play it. Go ahead. I like doo-wop. Go ahead.
I'll always want to.
All right, that'll work.
Because my heart is true.
No, I'm too old for this. Turn it off already. I don't feel cheerful about it. I don't know. I'm like, I don't feel focused today. I just feel very unfocused. I think it's my car. I'm having trouble with my car, and it's bothering me. I think I'm more connected to my car than I like to believe. Can you imagine having a car that's less than 3 years old, an expensive Mercedes? I drive an S600. About a couple of weeks ago, I came back from Florida, and the car, like the hydraulic fluid, it started to smell, and I couldn't turn the wheel. So they took the car, and it turns out that it blew a hydraulic line. All right, this happens in a car. It's three times already the car was brought in and they allegedly used, steam cleaning. The car still stinks like burning rubber and is bothering me. I will not drive a car that smells of burning rubber. Now, to top it off, it comes back today. I'm about to sign off on it. A gouge in the right fender down to the metal, to bare metal. Can you believe this? Maybe that's what's upsetting me. I don't know. Maybe I'm more connected. Look, a man in the Middle East is connected to his camel. Isn't a man judged by his horse or his camel? Men related to their horses, to their camels, to their cars, to their planes, to their boats. I hate to admit it, that I probably am more connected to, how about the five Statons in the still of the night? Because if this keeps up, even five Statons are not going to save me today. And we'll play in the still of, we'll play in the still of the night. All right, a little bump and grind. That was a beautiful song in its day. Today, nothing. Kids can't even dance to this. They don't hold. They don't hold while they dance. They do individual dancing. The guy doesn't hold the girl anymore. They put on a show for each other. Two narcissists in the night on ecstasy. No, that's the whole thing. In other words, it's not male and woman, man and woman coming together at a dance. It's, if you notice it, it's the girl putting on a striptease type of a bump and grind, and the guy is standing there trying to imitate the girl. It is the new dancing. How about another one? I think I'm just going to do music for a little while. If you want to call about any news topic, you know the number, right? You know, one of my favorite ones out there is, why do I like this one? How about Sorry I Ran All the Way Home by the Impalas? I guess I like the idea that it was the Impala, because in 1958, there was a Chevy Impala with 3 2-barrel carburetors that was so beautiful. And there was a rock and roll singer from the neighborhood who became very famous. Today, he's nothing. He's still performing. I can't imagine he has much. What's his name? Could you play this one? Sorry I Ran All the Way Home, rock and roll. Okay, that's good. I am so glad that I was a late bloomer. What would I have done if I was an early bloomer and hit it big at 16 and was a burnout by 30? This way I struggled my entire life, suffered, walked on hot coals. And by the time you earn, you know, your mild acclaim and your fortune, it's too late, because at the end of the day, you don't even want to spend it. There's nothing you want. You're so burned out by life, there's nothing you want, truthfully, except a good meal and a night's sleep. I guess I should take a break. I'll be right back. Savage. It is the Savage Nation. We're talking about the state of affairs in the United States of Obama. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. A man who has gone from being a green, unknown leftist is now suddenly a macho supporter of the 101st Airborne and the SEALs, which is a good turnaround for America, frankly. I'd like to see who he whacks next. One a month would be good till the election. Now, the 18 terrorist leaders would be okay for me. I might even vote for him. If he whacked 18 terrorist leaders one a month until the election, assuming there's 18 months left, I haven't done the math, that wouldn't be a bad scorecard. You know, when you think about it, 18 of them wouldn't be too bad at all. Let's take your calls. Oh, here's a good one. Mike in New York, WOR. What's on your mind, Mike?
Dr. Savage, this is how it's going right now. 32 years old, and I live in the heart of New York City, in one of the rural counties surrounding it. And it's hitting me about my father at 32 years old. He was fresh off the boat from Italy, roughly 5 or 6 years. He had 3 kids and a mortgage on a house and a pretty good job. Me, on the other hand, I'm a college graduate. I live in a basement apartment, and I can't even fathom the difference in 32 when he was 32 and 32 when I'm in 32. I feel like it's...
I know what you're... So in other words, you're comparing yourself to your father, and you're asking yourself why, if I have a college degree, I'm living in a basement apartment when at my age he was here already as an immigrant, he had kids in a house. How did he do it?
Exactly, Doctor.
It just shows you crime pays. What, was he in the mafia?
No, he was actually in the Italian army, and his family had already started migrating over here. When his father had enough money, he sent for him and his mother.
No, come on, but seriously, what did your father do for a living? Obviously, he worked somewhere. What did he do?
He started selling clothes. It wasn't even really selling clothes. He was working in, like, a Macy's department store, shoveling boxes. He didn't like it.
How did he own a house after 5 years of doing that? You sure that's all he was doing? I mean, I don't want to cast any aspersions on your father. It sounds odd to me that a newly arrived immigrant in 5 years could have a mortgage and 3 kids... shoveling, you know, filling boxes at Macy's.
It was him, my mother, her mother, and her brother.
You mean living in the house?
Yeah, they were all paying this mortgage. But
all right, so now this is very interesting. In the previous generations, people did pool their resources in order to buy property, and that's one of the situations that is not currently going on in this country. Families are all so dispersed and atomized that isn't happening. I mean, that is, you know, like if you moved in with your sister and somebody else, and then you put down a mortgage on a small house somewhere in one of the boroughs, I'm sure you could find one, right?
Not, you know what, Dr. Savage, houses right now here in the surrounding area have dropped to $500,000 in some areas, and that's really good in New York. But I can tell you, I couldn't cut a mortgage unless it was under, let's say, 17, 1600 a month at
best. Whoa. But let's say the house is 500 grand for a very small first time buyer attached house of the kind I lived in Queens when I was a kid. I'm picking an example, right? An attached row house. That's what I lived in my entire childhood, right? In Queens. One house next to the other where the walls were shared with little gardens in the back. To me, it was a paradise having come from the Bronx. So everything is relative. So let's say you buy one of those for 500,000. You put down 20%, whatever it may be. That's 100 grand down. You do it through pooling it with two relatives. I'm making up a scenario, right? And then you have a mortgage of $400,000 in a mortgage spread over 30 years. You could afford that mortgage split three ways.
Well, to be honest with you, Dr. Savage, right now with my current job, I probably don't pull any more than $45,000 in after taxes. I mean, that's roughly, what, $30,000?
I understand. I get it. So that's why you're making the call. But you're only working one job, and I don't mean to be a little rude on this phone call, but my suggestion is if you're not happy with how much you're making, you have to find another way to make more money. This is what motivates people to move ahead in a capitalist society. In other words, around you, you see people riding around in limousines, and you say, how the hell did they get there, right?
Indeed.
All right. Well, you're not going to get there by resenting them the way most Democrats would have you believe they stole it from somebody, because it's not true. In some cases it is, but the majority of people worked for it. So now you're saying, you know what? I'm never going to get anywhere doing what I'm doing. All I have is a lousy college degree. It isn't worth jack. It isn't worth the paper it's written on. So what am I going to do to become affluent in this society? And that's how it starts. You know, you have to continuously challenge yourself, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, work two jobs, come up with a product, become a super salesman, get a product that somebody wants, run around with it at night while other people are partying, you're selling product. You can make more money if you work more. And then you've got to find a new way to make money. Did I kickstart you at all? I hope so. Thanks for the call. Because I can't give you specific advice. It took me many, many decades to get really where I wanted to be. I worked very hard. You've got to do the same.
Savage.
We are also joined by Hispanic Americans serving at every level of my administration, some who've contributed to a new website that we launched this week, whitehouse.gov/Hispanic. So check out the website.
It's disgusting. I'm sick of it. This ethnic division by Obama is embarrassing, frankly. We live in a pluralistic nation. He is dividing and conquering. Anyway, the most expensive gasoline in America is $6.03 a gallon in Hana on the island of Maui. Regular gas, $6.03 a gallon. Cheapest place, convenience store in Casper, Wyoming, regular was selling for $3.36 a gallon. I have not been to Hana on Maui in 30 years. People go there, I know that. Death Valley I don't go to, never liked it. You know, Mule Team Borax. Why would anyone go to Death Valley? Scenic drive on Highway 90 lead you to the Furnace Creek Resort, where regular was selling for $5.75 a gallon. Why would anyone go to Death Valley? I remember when I was a kid, I would watch television. There was some show with Mule Team Borax. And anyway, whatever. Gas. This should sink any president, but not him. All he's got to do is keep killing terrorists. You'll be paying $10 a gallon and say he's terrific. Euro tumbles, Greece denies. Greece wants to flee the euro now. Why would they flee the euro when they've been bailed out? Chicago, Bruce, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I appreciate your dedication and work. And I just want to ask your opinion, when you have sinus congestion, cold, and trying to get over it, using a neti pot.
You know, you ask the wrong person. These hippie... Let's start with this. I mean, I am an expert at herbal medicine. I've written books on homeopathy and such, and I do believe to a certain extent in alternative medicine. So let's frame it that way. However, when it comes to sticking a neti pot with salt water into my nostril and having it run all over my clothing, I mean, there's a limit to how far into the third world healing I am willing to go. If you're interested in using something in your nostrils because of sinus congestion that's a little less dramatic, I would suggest buying a little salt water, you know, the saline sprays in a drugstore.
Yep.
Or, for that matter, you can mix salt water in your own house and inhale it. It'll run down your throat and all over your neck anyway. The neti pot thing is very, very Nelly. It's very Nelly. I'm sorry. You've tried it with the spout in the nostril?
I haven't tried it yet. I was told about it and didn't know if it was going to be anything.
There's something icky about the neti pot that I can't get into. I mean, if I were to use a neti pot on a clogged nostril, it would have to be in a bathtub. It's going to run all over your neck, down on your lip. I mean, you want, like, mucus on your neck? You know, the reason they could use it in India is that they basically don't believe in dry cleaning, number one. And number two, they could do it while they're swimming in the Ganges River. You know, take your neti pot and go have a bath in the Ganges. But it's not made for Westerners who are sitting in a normal environment who basically want to wear a white shirt and tie in the morning, you know. But look, to each his own. Today in America, anything goes, including neti pots, I suppose. Andy in Chicago. Is that Jandy or Andy? My eyes are blurry. Andy, what's on your mind, Andy?
You know, it's a curse when people call you with stuff like that because you're so graphic. I'm just cringing in my car. So,
No, I have a gift with words, but if he's going to ask me about a neti pot, what can I say to him other than there's a certain limit to how much into the third world I'm going to go? I do not want mucus from my nose all over my collar, no.
But it's just horrible the way you describe it. It's like I'm sitting in my car and it's real. Stop yourself. Hey, I want to talk about gardening. First of all, I have two dogs that are diggers. I don't have a lot to I need to plant in a pot. And also, more importantly, I want to know what you're planting this year.
I planted tomatoes, Italian parsley, basil, and I have a bunch of fruit trees. However, almost all my fruit trees are infected with a fungal disease this year, which is common now in the San Francisco Bay Area. They all have a curly leaf disease, which is caused by a countywide fungus. So unfortunately, the trees are being sprayed. We are spraying them with an organic spray, so the fruit will still be useful, but it's pretty horrible to see that.
How about something that maybe you could plant? I have a 9-year-old daughter who wants to plant carrots. And I have two dogs that love to dig.
Our carrots are good, but, you know, I don't know. Do you cook? So Italian parsley's nice to plant. I'm very impressed with the pots that they give you now that come out of nurseries, which have they're like an earth pot that you can put right in the ground. Have you seen them? They're amazing.
No.
You gently tear the bottom of the pot off. They have the seedlings in them, right? And you gently tease off the bottom of the pot, which is sort of a compost paper type of pot. And then you pull out the tendrils very delicately. You tease them out. You dig a hole. You put the whole pot right in the ground. It's got pre-fertilized. And this is the most amazing thing that they've developed. So it's almost impossible to screw up having something grow. I mean, I planted my tomatoes out here in California in very late March. I prefer planting them in early March, but they were not available. You want to get the tomatoes in by early April, the latest on the West Coast. But you're in Chicago, which is just the right time for you, right?
Right. Right now, I mean, we got a little bit of weather and, you know, Mother's Day, so I'm going to put my wife to work planting.
Yeah, but, you know, plants are amazing for children because I remember as a kid, you talk about graphic. I remember in the third, fourth grade, they had us grow lima beans. Kids don't know the first thing about reality. When we sprouted lima beans and I saw a shoot come out of it, I was astounded to understand that inherent in a bean was life itself. In other words, the whole concept of living foods came home to me crystal clear. It's a beautiful thing to teach your children how to plant things.
That's what she learned was when we planted a bean, you know how the bean actually comes up, the shell of the bean comes out of the ground on the plant? That's what actually got her very, very excited about it.
That's right, and it takes the child's mind away from the computer and away from the fantasy on the computer into the reality of the earth. There's really nothing better. I'm 100% for little, even gardens in cities. You could do them in windowsills. If you got sunlight and you keep up the watering, you can do them there. But I don't want to do a gardening show. I mean, gardening is nice. It's not like my whole life. It's just beautiful. That's something Michelle Obama and I share, is a love for vegetable gardens. Oh, here we go. Another neti pot call. Just what I need. Okay, if you got disgusted by the last neti pot call, I'd recommend that you put it on mute for a minute. Frankie in Chicago, go ahead, please.
You know, the neti pot thing. My mother says, oh, my boyfriend uses a neti pot. Try it. It works. All it did was irritate my mucous membranes more. Not only did it do that.
Why are so many American men suddenly sticking teapots in their nose?
I have no idea. But
what did the Indians run out of a market for teapots so they came up with this neti pot concept?
It's just doesn't make sense.
I mean, next they'll sell them for, shall I say, ears. An ear. They'll call it an ear. You get an earache, stick the neti pot in your ear. They'll work your way down the body.
Yeah, the whole allergy thing. I understand people's problems with allergies, and they're looking for alternatives. But as far as taking salt, basically, it's pouring it into the...
Well, all right, now let's start. Salt water is very therapeutic for irritated sinus cavities, incidentally. It's just a matter of whether or not you want to... apply it using a neti pot or just simply buy a little spray at a drugstore. I mean, I prefer the more, let us say, westernized approach, which is a little bottle of saline solution.
The amount, you know, they tell you to put in there.
Oh, it's horrible. No, it's disgusting till it runs in the back. It's graphically disgusting. This is something that I have to cut off at a certain point. Because once it goes in the back of your throat, you can't ever eat food again. Nothing ever tastes right. Once you let's cut it off right there because I can get even more graphic, and I don't really mean to, just for shock value. You want to talk about peach trees or Osama bin Laden? Sacramento, Terry, go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah, stop with the pots. Yeah, your peaches have peach leaf curl that has nothing to do with the Bay Area. It's all over California fruit orchards this year because all the rain we had. And the best thing you can do is just keep your trees healthy, put compost, or I don't do organic, fertilize them to get those leaves growing.
Oh, so in other words, even if we spray them, it's the fruit's shot.
Yeah, well, your fruit's not shot. You got to get your leaves growing again. If you get some fertilizer on them, it'll shoot.
What do you mean? You're saying that they were overwatered from the heavy rains this winter?
No, there's a fungus that's endemic in California. It's there every year. And it's exacerbated by a lot of rainfall. So
okay.
I'm over in the Fresno County area where there's we have 100,000 acres of peach trees there, and there's guys that have done everything, myself included, and I have peach leaf curl. And what you do is you just grow the tree out of it. But next winter,
okay,
make sure you put a dormant spray on it, a copper Bordeaux that kills that fungus in the dormant season.
I get it. So what should I do right now? What are you saying? Just keep the tree healthy with fertilizer and let it grow itself out is what you're suggesting.
It's going to drop all those leaves, and what you need to do is just put just light fertilizer every couple of weeks. So if you're doing the organic thing, get fish emulsion or whatever those guys say to use.
God, I got to go kill fish and grind them into the fish powder. All right, well, good. Thanks for the tip. You're an actual farmer. That's good enough for me. I had prize apricots. I have a small hillside orchard in one of my properties, and it was a prize 25-year-old apricot orchard when I bought it. And I'll tell you, each year it's gotten worse. So let's not do any more gardening calls here. Let's see what's in the news. The answer is nothing. I mean, unless you want to hear the Cinco de Mayo and Osama bin Laden, it's enough already. We know the story. I salute the president. They did a great job. He should get credit for it. Okay, it's good. Now let's move on. That's all. Don't take it away from them. The way they handled it was a nightmare. I mean, they purposely screwed it up. So bin Laden is dead. Even Al-Qaeda said it today. Here's some news for you. Ready? Chief executives say California, worst place in the nation to do business. SACB by Mark Lover. For the seventh year in a row, a survey of chief executives ranked California as the nation's worst state in which to do business. Jerry Brown, are you paying attention? More than 500 U.S. CEOs polled by Greenwich, Connecticut-based Chief Executive Mag based their opinions on numerous factors, including regulations, tax policies, workforce quality. Don't get me started on workforce quality. That means employees. California happens to be the most difficult state in America to find employees that understand what work means and are willing to work. You know what I'm saying? It's amazing. Florida has a much better worker base than California. I live in both states, mainly in California, but I noticed even getting your boat washed, you can more easily find people to wash your boat better at a better price in Florida than you can here in California. I don't know what it is. There's an attitude here that's all screwed up. People come here with a terrible, terrible attitude towards work. I knew what would happen. Once I started to lie, I'll give you another story now. Let's see to get your intro. political witchcraft, Air Force witchcraft. Did you hear this story? The U.S. Air Force Academy held a ceremony on Tuesday to dedicate a pile of rocks in the Academy's worship area for followers of Earth-centered religions. This is a space that U.S. Air Force cadets can use to perform rituals if they happen to be witches, warlocks, and tree worshippers. So that's what's going on now in the U.S. Air Force Academy. And then the Air Force said, the U.S. Air Force remains neutral regarding religious beliefs and will not officially endorse nor disprove any faith, belief, or absence of belief. So in other words, now they're equating worshiping a rock to Christianity and to Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam. I think they can cut it off and say, witches need not apply. Go ahead and sue us, and we'll send in the SEALs to get you if you don't like it, or don't join to begin with. Osama bin Laden's death, $25 million reward, likely to remain secret forever. U.S. to investigate Muslim groups' border complaints. Ah, give me a break. CAIR is still complaining. Why don't you send the SEALs to give them an interrogation? Maybe the SEALs can interrogate the Council on American Islamic Relations and ask them why they're constantly bellyaching. I'll be right back. Savage. Nation. It's Friday. It's Rock and Roll Friday in the Savage Nation. If you're listening to me somewhere in America on my over 300 affiliates, that's good for you. Goody, goody for you. Goody, goody for me. I have a treat coming up for you in a moment, but I want to take a call out of New York on WOR regarding the smell of hydraulic fluid in the engine compartment of my car. Lorenzo, how do you get rid of it? What do you suggest?
Hi, Michael. Yeah, when you bring your car back to a dealer, tell them to change your cabin air filter. There's an air filter in the dashboard, you know, that will clean up the air for you, and that will probably get rid of your smell.
Well, it's not that it's coming into the passenger compartment all the time. When I stop the car in a garage or I get out of it, you can smell it still burning off around the engine. You know what I'm saying? The residual oil is still there. They can't get it off the engine.
Yeah, that smell will be there for a long time. But if you have a brand new air filter and then turn on your air conditioning, your car will smell like it's brand new all over again.
Yeah, I don't like the idea of inhaling toxic fumes, though. That's the problem. How do you feel about a dealer who sends a car back to you with a gouge in the fender without telling you and you have to find it?
Oh, that's horrible management.
Terrible. Terrible. Embarrassing, frankly. You know, I care for my cars like they're new. When I was a kid, because I was poor, I had three pair of shoes. I'd line them up under my bed and I keep them polished. That's the way I was, right? I was like fanatic. Same with cars and boats. Everything I own, immaculate. Perfect. That's how I keep it. I have a car 3 years, not a scratch in it. It comes back from the dealer with a gouge down to the paint. It got me sick today. So even if they paint the fender, it's never going to be the same. Impossible. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I've got some good callers. I got good callers. Let's see. Here's a good one out of Mississippi. Stefan, welcome to the program.
Yes, Dr. Savage, my question is, with all your PhDs and master's degrees in herbology, how did you get started in radio?
Well, first of all, my PhD is in nutrition epidemiology from the University of California at Berkeley. You know, it's in nutrition, human nutrition and epidemiology, two hard sciences. I had two previous master's degrees, one in medical anthropology and one in medical botany. The medical botany master's was equal to a high-end PhD anywhere else because my master's thesis was published in a journal that is published at Harvard University. So my master's level thesis was as good as anyone's PhD, if not better. How did I go from all of that to talk radio is the question?
Yes, sir.
Oh, it's such a long story. It's worthy of an autobiography. I'll have to summarize it in some regard. I'll make it as short as I can. I don't want to bore anybody. Let us say, because I was a white male, I was denied access to the universities, which is really what I wanted at the time, because I would have been a great scholar. I had shown great promise and published some incredibly insightful scientific papers, but they were not hiring white males at the time in these fields. They were only hiring incompetents from the third world or women with 10th rate degrees. And that's why the fields have produced little or no scholarship whatsoever. So I had to reinvent myself. So I did corporate consulting. I wrote books, et cetera, and so on. But I continued my research. I funded my own travels to the South Pacific. It was a big juggling act. And then around the year 1994, I sent out a demo tape to 450 radio stations that I put together, like a fake radio show with callers. My friends called in and all that. And about five radio stations said, "You're good. Would you like to, you know, be on our air?" Include one was in Boston, and a couple were in San Francisco. And then I went in and did fill-in work in San Francisco, night work, overnight fill-in. Then they offered me a full-time job. Then I was syndicated in the year 2000. And here it is. That's how it. That's basically the story.
Thank you very much, Fran.
Thanks for the call. In other words, I reinvented myself. See, the young man said he was fed up with he can't make a living, he can't make a job. Well, society said we have social engineering going on right now, and white males need not apply. Now, I could have spent the rest of my life as an embittered intellectual, hating the world. They did it to me, chip on my shoulder, and gotten nowhere the rest of my life. I could have been one of the bums sitting in a cafe, disgruntled, you know, retired or living on SDSI or whatever I put together in my life, been just a miserable human being the way most of these disgruntled people are. Instead, because I didn't want to be a loser and a bad role model for my children, I decided to struggle at age 50 and start all over again, which I did. Which I did, by the way. And, you know, here I am, thank God. No one gave it to me, okay? I had to claw it out of the ground. But here I am, and thank God, because I prayed for it, to be frank with you.
Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
This is Captain Mike down at the waterfront. You can hear the gulls in the background. Been feeding him the scraps from the table. Gave him the old turkey this morning. Teddy was jumping up and down and saying, "Why not me? Why not me?" You know, I've been reading since I wrote the novel and waiting for it to come out, Abuse of Power, St. Mons. It'll be out in September. I've been reading more again. I got sick and tired of reading, you know, websites for news stories about how bad Obama is. I mean, it's all true, but I can only take so much. So I went back to what I used to do most, which is I started reading literature. And I walked my way backwards by reading a contemporary novel, which is fairly well written. But then I got bored very quickly because they're superficial in so many ways. So I went back to Joseph Conrad, who I cut my teeth on. And it's important for me to read you a couple of paragraphs from Joseph Conrad about when a ship goes down and people die, or what would happen if a ship went down and people died. It's from a story in his fiction, The Mirror of the Sea, published way back in 1906. Now, I don't know if Joseph Conrad is taught anymore, but something you should know about Joseph Conrad is that he was born in Poland. His native language was Polish, and he learned English and became established as one of the greatest writers of the 20th century in English, to show you what you can do if you have a brain and if you have talent. And I do not believe he took education courses put out by a government that taught, English as a second language with Polish instruction. I don't believe so. I think he taught himself English. So The Mirror of the Sea was published in 1906, and it's a collection of Conrad's autobiographical reflections on man and his relationship to ships and the ocean. I found this in an old yachting magazine that I was about to, you know, throw out. It was a couple of years old, for November 2010. And I said, wait a minute, Joseph Conrad. So let me read you a paragraph for the heck of it, okay, just for a change of pace. He's talking about being on a ship, a 1,000-ton bark, I think is what it was. I can't find the exact. Here it is. Our craft, a Clyde-built bark of 1,000 tons, was rolling to the point where he thought that he'd be thrown off the mast. So they went up on the mast to see what was going on. The decks were full of water. The gears were flying, and they were still running at 10 knots an hour. And then he's up on the mast, and suddenly up there in the slings of the foreyard in the midst of our work, I felt my shoulder gripped with such force in the carpenter's powerful paw that I positively yelled with unexpected pain. The man's eyes stared close in my face, and he shouted, "Look, sir, look, what's this?" pointing ahead with his other hand. At first, I saw nothing. The sea was one empty wilderness of black and white hills. Suddenly, half concealed in the tumult of the foaming rollers, I made out a wash. Something enormous rising and falling, something spread out like a burst of foam, but with a more bluish, more solid look. It was a piece of an ice floe, melted down to a fragment, but still big enough to sink a ship and floating lower than any raft right in our way, as if ambushed among the waves with murderous intent. There was no time to get down on the deck. I shouted from aloft till my head was ready to split. I was heard aft, and we managed to clear the sunken floe, which had come all the way from the southern ice cap, to have a try at our unsuspecting lives. Had it been an hour later, nothing could have saved the ship, for no eye could have made out in the dusk that pale piece of ice swept over by the white-crested waves. And as we stood near the taffrail, side by side, my captain and I, looking at it, hardly discernible already, but still quite close to on our quarter, he remarked in a meditative tone, "But for the turn of that wheel just in time, there would have been another case of a missing ship." Now, ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, I'm going to read you the last paragraph, because this now goes to you, whether you are on a ship or in a car, whether you're sitting in a house or rotting in a jail cell, because it's so universal in its description of what happens when a human dies. Listen how he ends this little tale. "Nobody ever comes back from a missing ship to tell how hard was the death of the craft and how sudden and overwhelming the last anguish of her men. Nobody can say with what thoughts, with what regrets, with what words on their lips they died. But there is something fine in the sudden passing away of these hearts from the extremity of struggle and stress and tremendous uproar, from the vast unrestful rage of the surface to the profound peace of the depths, sleeping untroubled since the beginning of ages." Now that's writing, that's literature, that's Joseph Conrad, an excerpt from The Mirror of the Sea. Very nice, Michael. Applauding for myself. It's such a, you know, this is such an isolated profession. It's incomprehensible. It's one thing if you do it in front of a live audience. You do it on a radio show. You don't even know if anyone went to sleep. Did anyone enjoy that? Or you would rather I never read literature again? Just that. Obama's no good. Dems are commies. No, I mean, it's all true, but how much can I do of it? There's only a limit to it. I just wrote out my order of food for the night for this weekend. Atlantic smoked salmon, bagels, 4 dolmas, and a small milk for the missus when she comes over for the coffee. Humble guy, go out in the boat. I'm not going to hit an ice floe this weekend in the Bay Area. Don't worry about it. Okay, 1-800-449-8255. I can't take any of these calls up there. I can't jump from this to that. Any literature calls out there? I'm dead in the water. No one heard it. No one's interested. Does anyone listen to talk radio anymore? Is this whole field dead? No one cares anymore? I mean, with Romney, with Mitt Romney as the front runner for the Republicans, you may as well forget the whole picture. He already came out and saluted Obama today for not releasing the photo. That's Mitt Romney for you. Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi is what you get. Socialist Coke or Socialist Pepsi. Either or. Here's a guy in his 162-foot yacht showing off with his young girlfriend with the fake boob job. Making memories with his girlfriend and President Joe and his wife, Jean. Some men live for this, to have the big boat and the picture of them with the young girlfriend. 4 years later, click, click. 2 years later, they got a half a baby between them. The yacht she owns, she took the yacht. Oh, guys, will they ever learn? There's no beating it. Don't you understand there's no beating life? Marrying a young woman when you're that age is like hitting an ice floe. No matter which way it is, you're going to get hit with that ice floe, whether it's initially or late. Take a look at Mel Gibson. Don't they understand it? I mean, because I read that Paul McCartney just getting married again to some girl he met in the Hamptons. And he made an interesting statement, McCartney. He said, "I like being in love." Well, that's very nice. I mean, the last one he just got rid of with the one leg sure was a nice love story, wasn't it? The one legger must have cost him $300 million for being in love. Love is a fantasy. Don't you understand that love was invented in the Middle Ages during the Renaissance, that there was no love before that? Hey, shall I tell you my cynical view of love? Because it's true. See, America lives in a fantasy, which is beautiful. We all share in this social construct, all of our social constructs. We all share in them or negate them, but we all share in them one way or the other, either by believing them or negating them. Love is a social construct that, according to my reading of literature, did not exist prior to the period that Shakespeare wrote in. In other words, I'm not saying everyone was a caveman before then, but they married for reasons other than, oh my God, she's my soulmate, and I met her on 48th and 3rd Avenue when I was out walking my terrier, and she's my soulmate. There never was a thing called a soulmate. The religious Jews who I knew many years ago taught their children that you marry someone for other reasons and you learn to love each other. That's the way they pick. They pick based upon family lineage and the ability to raise a family and things of that nature. And then when the couple lives together, they learn to love each other. Usually the marriage lasts longer than if you, oh my God, met her in the, oh my God, 90 days later already, that they got a half a baby each. And they don't understand why the marriage didn't last. Because what you did was you married a fantasy. Nobody can live up to a fantasy. It was like based upon what you ate that day. And like the alignment of the planets. So, see, the whole concept has to be changed. And I think we're going to go into arranged marriages very soon in America all over again. Now, no, I'm pretty sure we're going to head there. I have a whole other theory about social behavior that's coming, that's emerging in my head, which is that we're living through one of the most libertine ages in American history where everybody's doing it like bees and bugs. Bees and bugs. Human beings are now mating in the Western world like bees and bugs. So for whatever it is, without negating it, they are. That's why the white people are no longer having babies, by and large, and such, and why the entire population is dying out, other than immigrants who are having children. So what's going to happen, and I don't know when, how many years, my suspicion is that there's going to be an emerging generation that is the opposite of this lascivious, do-it-in-the-road type of generation. And I think we're going to go back to an almost Victorian sensibility with regard to sexuality. That's what I think is going to happen in this country. I don't mean tomorrow. I mean, I'll be laughed out of the theater if I said it was going to happen in the next few years. It's not happening in the next few years, but it is going to happen in this country. There's going to be a movement away from the why not do it in the road mentality. Now, if you care to comment on it, I'm not the right guy to call. Take it up with your priest or your psychiatrist. I got nothing more to say on it. I just felt like sharing after reading Joseph Conrad. Because of all that beautiful writing by Conrad, I want to go back to one line in there that struck me worthy of reading to you on the air and taking up your valuable time. And he's talking about nobody ever comes back from a missing ship, okay? Now listen to this, the last anguish of her men. Nobody can say with what thoughts, with what regrets, with what words on their lips they died. And I said to myself, boy, is that universal. Because that talks to all of us. So when I went to high school, for example, if they taught us Joseph Conrad, who we read, by the way, in Jamaica High School, the teacher explained to us why he was considered one of the great writers of the 20th century. It's because he could write a novel that was a good story, and within the story there were universal truths, the truths that people could relate to, whether they were at sea or not at sea. Nobody can say with what thoughts, with what regrets, and with what words on the lips they died. Isn't that true for you? Doesn't that also speak to you? You think you're not going to die that way? You think you're not or I'm not going to die in the same exact way with thoughts and regrets and words on my lips as I die? We're all going to die with unfulfilled promise and unrequited dreams. And again, this goes to a social point I was trying to make on this show. The myth and the fantasy put out by the news/entertainment media is so overwhelming that they have the entire population hoodwinked into believing that if only you were a slut like Lindsay Lohan, or only if you were a degenerate like one of the Hollywood, you know, gigolos running around, you'd be happy like them. It's absurd. They're not happy. They're on drugs and they're in rehab, in and out of rehab and drugs. Why? because their lifestyle is unfulfilling. Don't you understand it? They're trying to beat the rap. You can't beat the rap, man. The rap is life. The Buddhists have it right. The Buddhists say it's a wheel. It's the wheel of suffering. And the day you accept the fact that you are put on this earth to suffer is the day you'll suffer less. I'll be right back.
Come with me, my love, to the sea of love. I want to tell you how.
It is the Savage Nation heard across America. So as we broke off for the commercial messages, I went into a little philosophy, and I said, the day you realize we're put on this earth to suffer is the day you suffer less, which came out of me. And I felt liberated from a certain struggle that's going on within myself right now. And I wanted to tell you, my audience, something. The thing that motivates me most about doing radio is a moment like that. Is that I struggle just as you do in trying to punch through the daily grind, so to speak, the rote, just being another mote in the mire and struggling along until the day we're gone. And the fact is that only at a moment like that, when I come up with ideas that I think are valid and quotables, do I feel validated. I felt as though I produced a pearl from within the oyster of pain and the oyster of suffering. So I don't want to over-dramatize the issue of suffering, because I know what real suffering is, and this is not suffering. This is more or less the proper word would be the anguish of life itself, because life is anguishing. And part of the problem with our society is the mythology that everyone's happy but you. The Real Housewives of New York. The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. The Real Housewives of Washington. Mob wives, they're all such big mouths, and they're all so happy, and they're all having such dramatic lives, and only you're home alone, isolated and alone and suffering. Only you are, not them. They find these low lives and put a camera in front of them, and suddenly they're a star. And the fact of the matter is, everybody is the same exact way. And no matter what show they put on, like the other guy's happy every minute, he's got the yacht and the wife. Sure, he's probably got more happiness than the guy riding the subway. In the sense of self-achievement. But I don't for a minute. See, I have a strange thing about it. I have a strange view of life. I happen to believe that in a way, I've held this belief since I'm 17. It's a certain quotient I've had in my mind, and maybe it's a mythology of my own, but everybody invents them in order to get through life. But I used to come to the understanding, I came to the understanding in my own life that I think that in the whole scheme of life, unless it's cut short in childhood or something like that, I think that there's a balance between the kind of the suffering that we all go through and the sadness, meaning the very rich man riding around in a limousine, he's full of anguish. He's got 40 lawsuits going on at any one time. He's got the third young wife of his life who's probably cheating on him, or he's got a private detective watching to make sure she isn't. She's in hell because she married an old dude that she can't stand. But she's got to shine it on every day. Then they got a kid in rehab who can't stand both of them and knows it's all bogus. Even though he lives in a 16-room apartment on Fifth Avenue, he's still miserable, more miserable than the kid who's working, delivering a newspaper because he's got no reason to live. So at the end of the day, there's some kind of quotient that God creates for all of us, I used to think. And maybe I was mythologizing the whole, making the whole thing up in order to justify my own struggles. But at the end of the day, truthfully, to me, radio is not so much about making money or showing you how smart I am or whatever, ratings. It's coming, punching through the vicissitudes of existence and for a moment flying like an eagle, coming up with a word, a concept, a stringing of words that might liberate someone listening to this program for a moment and make them realize that there's a universality in their struggles, that they're not alone, that they're not alone.
Savage.
Well, love, love, darling, come and go with me. Come with me, way beyond the sea. I need you, darling, so come go with me.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation on this Rock and Roll Friday. I'm in a kind of weird mood. weird mood. I don't know what it is. I think that's too much with the politics and Obama with his grandstanding and taking credit for something he really didn't do, and the media saluting him again like suddenly he's a big war hawk. The guy, he never shot a gun in his life, anti-gun, anti-police, anti-military. All of a sudden, he's Mr. Gung-Ho. Okay, I mean, that's just the way the game is played. It can wear you out. Feds say, federal government gave out an edict today that all children, legal or not, are entitled to K-12 education. So no matter which way you turn, they're polluting the nation with their liberalism, period. Stupid. What do you mean entitled to K-12 education? They're not citizens. What do you mean entitled? Who's going to pay for it? Let me take some calls. Las Vegas. Cal, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, I wanted to tell you, Joseph Conrad has always been my favorite author, and that you read, you do affect people, because it's very interesting. I've been trying to write what I would have said had I not died at that moment to my children, and I'm entitling that, what I would have said had I not already died.
Oh, my God, so that's very interesting. Yeah, because in other words, before it's too late to get it out.
Exactly, and there's so many things that you have in your mind that are going to be unsaid. Even though I'm writing this, there'll be even more. And I just, you know, I really love your show, and I love the direction that you take me in, which is very often pearls. And that's the other thing. I collect pearls in my life. And when you said the pearl, I mean, just very, very much thinking. And the other thing I wanted to agree with you, I'm a sex therapist in Vegas, and I'm finding people very uninterested in this free sex. I'm finding young men who are becoming impotent because they just don't want to have sex, but rather than say it, their body says it for them. The boredom that's creeping into sexuality. I think we're going to eventually, you know, 20, 30, 50 years, really go backwards.
So you agree with me that there will be a movement towards this Victorian so-called prudishness again. I think it'll be much faster than that time frame. My guess is it's going to be within 10 years. 10 to 12 years, there's going to be an entire reversal of this libertine, anything goes, let's do it in the road, you know, and the whole sluttiness is going to come to an end as well.
I absolutely see it. My grandson is 22 years old, and he called me the other night to say he's so happy to be sleeping alone. He said, I just feel so great. I'm alone, and I feel comfortable, and I love it. He says, I'm tired of these women. And it's just not him. I mean, my patients are saying the same kind of things.
But when you're a sex therapist, what is the primary thrust of the complaints people bring to you?
Well, primarily I work with couples who are just bored with each other and trying to keep some kind of flame alive. But I also am seeing young men, and this happened interestingly in the 70s, young men who were thinking they were impotent because their body was not responded to a woman coming on to them. And they really weren't. They just were not interested, and their body was reacting rather than their mind.
Well, I remember being taught back in Psych 101 at Queens College. I had a feminist professor, only we didn't know she was a feminist because they were not so self-designated in that time. So she said to us, the human being is the only animal on earth that thinks he is in heat 365 days a year. We didn't even know what she was talking about. And she said most animals go into a sexual heat during certain periods. Period. And the other times they're not interested at all. But man is so beaten to death with advertising and popular mythology that he thinks he's supposed to be ready at a moment's notice, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And if he isn't, there's something wrong with him.
Yeah, and it weighs very heavily, especially on young men and young women.
Right. And then the guy thinks he's gay. So then he goes down that road and finds out it's another false loop.
Exactly. I mean, the whole sexuality thing is so confusing and so demanding that it's not even fun anymore. And that's the problem. That's what's happening, and people are going away from it. They're really...
But a lot of people then go into internet porn. Let's be clear. It's a booming business. They give up human beings, and they become a fantasist completely. I bet you see a lot of that, too.
We live in a depersonalized, alienated world. This whole, diversity... When we came to America, when our parents came to America, we merged and we became Americans. Now we're keeping our country fractionalized. You have to keep, you know, your separate entities, your separate diversities. And instead of merging and coming together, we're all separated and alienated. And that's
But now that's a little separate, I think, from the concept of sexuality, which is your specialty. Of course, the sexual mores differ by culture as well. I would suspect, though, that most of the immigrants coming into America are far more sexually constrained than the population at large. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I really do. I think they're much
For example, African cultures are extremely restricted sexually. They're shocked by what they see here. People don't even understand that we are at the bottom of the barrel in terms of sexual behavior worldwide. That the very thing we think we are, we're the exact opposite. All of this libertinism is, in fact, a degeneracy of the human spirit. It's not the elevation of the human spirit. And that's all I'm saying, is that at some point there's going to be a gradual. Right now I can feel a gradualness moving in the other way, but there's got to be a limit to this, and I think we bottomed out a while ago.
Yeah, I see it. I see it happening. I really do. And maybe you're right. I think maybe it will be sooner than 30, 40 years.
So why are you writing a note to your children about what I wanted to say? Why do you suspect you should? Why do you feel you should do it now?
I was thinking exactly that. There's so much unsaid and undone, and then you're dead and it's too late. So why not put something in writing? I actually have a lot of written things that I've done for them, you know, over the years that I'm going to leave them. But this is the last thing. And,
very interesting.
Yeah,
it's funny. One of the characters in my novel says, I forget where, it's about terrorism, by the way, my novel, at the end of the day. It's a major terrorist plot that's interrupted by my hero, strangely enough. And I don't want to give any more of it away. But in one of the scenes, I have one of the characters saying, for the things that he said that he wished he had not said, for the things he did that he wished he had not done, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I think that's human life. In other words, can we ever take back some of the things we said that we wish we hadn't said? Can we ever say the things that we wish we had said that we have not said? No, we can't do that.
That's the, you know, Omar Khayyam, the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all the piety nor wit can move it back or cancel out a line of it. You can never.
No, I never heard that one. I mean, the closest I got to Omar Khayyam was Khalil Gibran.
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things that he said. You just cannot cancel anything, but you can give what you haven't given, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Oh, well, you mean because there's still time. You don't have to wait for the big deathbed scene.
No, and besides, I probably won't be able to say that much when I'm on the big deathbed.
I know, the big bed. The big bed. Oh, the big bed, horrible. Horrible. Well, let's not get too depressed right now, Cal. Thanks for calling the show. Hey, I don't mind. I really don't mind this. I think a lot of people like this because I don't hear this anywhere. You know, you turn on the TV, ha, 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 oh, I'm such a wise guy. Ha, ha, ha. Let me put down those Republicans. Ha, ha, ha. I'm a wise ass from Sunset Boulevard. Ha, ha, ha. Look at me, I'm Bill Maher. Ha, ha, ha. I got a wise crack for everyone. Ha, 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 ha. You know, who can take that crap after a while? Who can listen to these empty-headed schmucks disguising themselves as great sages of comedy? They're empty heads. They don't even write their own lines. All these schmendricks. So I get angry sometimes, and it comes out this way. That's why I do this. That's why I read Conrad. And now suddenly we're doing something else now, and now we're moving in a direction. I could do this for 5 hours. I'm not going to do it for five, but here it goes. That's how it happens. You know what I'm saying? Sacramento, California. Lance, you're on the Savage Nation.
Oh, Mike, I love it when you're in a mood like this. Thank you very much for the literature excursion. It's I wanted to vote in favor of it, and now I have to follow a sex therapist. How can I do that?
Well, it makes talk radio worth listening to, I got to tell you that, because I can guarantee if I was doing an Obama show for an hour, you'd be off the air already. You wouldn't listen to it anymore.
Well, exactly. The golfer's infomercial, I couldn't take it for more than about 15 minutes this morning. I'm just back from Europe for 6 weeks, and what a refreshing experience to hear your voice again. I was thinking about...
Oh, wait a minute. What do you? I don't want to bash him, but what was Golfy doing today?
Oh, it was just a standard infomercial. It was he had a new Shanklin routine, a song about a movie.
Okay. All right. So it's grade C comedy, but it's not bad for the lumpen proletariat. I get it.
Yeah. So here I am at the University of Savage again. I think I'm paying too little for the tuition, but there it is.
So Lance, what were you doing in Europa?
Well, I roamed around Portugal and Spain, beat the pee out of a Mitsubishi rental car. And
so you're like a young guy on the big trip to Europe?
I'm a senior fool. Gray hair speeding on the...
Oh, you're an old guy who sounds young. You're doing like the air-conditioned nightmare trip to Europe. We used to joke about it. When I was at Queens College, 17, we had nothing. And we used to, a guy who said to me, you know what, I'm leaving college. He said, I'm going to go to Europe and become a writer. He said, I don't want to wait till I'm old at 40, he said, and I'm going to go visit Europe in an air-conditioned Chrysler. That was the joke.
Oh, it was an air-conditioned Mitsubishi, but we didn't stay in air-conditioned hotels. It was all bottom-line stuff and toll.
Did you enjoy Portugal, though? You know, it's a funny thing. I've wanted to go to Portugal, a once-great empire. It reminds me of, well, I like ex-empires. There's something dramatically beautiful about fallen empires. Is Portugal, I understand Lisbon is somewhat like San Francisco, built up on hills.
Lisbon is a beautiful city, but of course it's just as dangerous as any other beautiful city. But the place I would really recommend that you go is the so-called Douro Valley. It's this river valley that has grapevines planted in it. It's the region from which port wines come from, and it is spectacularly beautiful there around
the... How's the food in Portugal?
Cannot complain. If you know what you're ordering, you will get quality food. They have...
I would imagine they're heavy on the calamari and seafood.
Absolutely. They've got the seafood, and they know what to do with a pig.
No, so do we. I think that you have to give the Navy SEALs credit for that as well.
Absolutely. Now, Michael, be careful. Don't get banned in Portugal, because I'm pretty sure you want to go there.
Okay. I'll make certain that I don't say anything negative about port wine, which I'm not a fan of, by the way. You know, the origin of port wine is very interesting. It was wine that was ruined through a long sea voyage. It's basically corked wine. How does that become good wine? How can anyone confuse corked wine, meaning port wine, with high-end wine? Why do people like it?
Well, I'm going to explain. I learned something about this. In fact, you're right about this brandy business. So what they did was they intentionally, to make this not in the cask, they stopped the fermentation with brandy so that the wine is still sweet. It doesn't become ultra dry wine like we tend to do in the...
I can't drink. See, I don't like Madeira wines at all. I get sick from them. I can only drink super dry wine. That's another reason I don't like port wine. I cannot stand malolactic fermented wine either. I get nauseated from the Chardonnays in California, which they've turned into like vanilla soda in order to please the young woman's taste.
Okay, well,
I grew up, as though I didn't have a lot of money, I sure had good taste. I grew up on Chablis number 1 and Grand Cru Chablis. With the first few dollars I had as a teacher, I used to drink Sante Million with dinner on my own in a little restaurant on 10th Avenue and 40 something Street, which is long gone. I'd sit alone and half a bottle of Sante Million. You're talking about tart tannic wine. That's the only kind of wine I can drink.
They're making that now. They've decided that it shouldn't all go to port. They have ultra-high-quality grapes there with all kinds of special varietals that are almost unique to Portugal. And they aren't using them to make port all the time anymore. They're making top-quality, cask-aged, oak-cask-aged.
All right. Well, the wine wouldn't be the reason I would go to Portugal. I'd go for other reasons. You know, one of the things I've wanted to see in Portugal, I saw a picture years ago that has stuck in my mind, which is of these high-walled estates from when Portugal was a great empire and there were great fortunes. These families have been rich for 200 years or more. They live behind 20-foot walls. Is that still true? Was there a section like that?
Well, I didn't go to that part of Lisbon, but I toured the castles on the Sintra Hill. A particular interest is the highest one, the Peña Castle.
Because I love in America, you can't have a wall higher than 6 feet. You hear this?
Yes.
A 6-foot wall is all they let you build. You hear, in this day and age, you have to go to some schmuck bureaucrat. He gives you permission to build a 6-foot wall. That's really protective against a kid who can jump over an 8-foot wall with one leap.
Well, look, Mike, if you want a higher wall, move to Pakistan.
It just shows you what a high wall does for you, huh, when they come in from the air.
Oh,
yeah.
My.
Well, I'm not Osama bin Laden. I'm not in that category of fear. Thanks for the call and for the compliments. I really appreciate it. Nice call. See, that is conversation when you can go from a philosophical blah, 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 all the way into port wine. That's called conversation. Remember this, okay? The word conversation means with verse, conversation. What does that mean? The purpose of conversation is to keep the conversation going. And unfortunately, because of a distortion in our culture, we think that the object of a conversation is to cut the other man off and make him into a fool. And that's where you get the morons on television like Bill Maher. Let me tell you this. Cut off. In other words, book a Republican Schmendrick on with five schmuck liberals and make him look like a moron and think that makes you smart. That's not conversation. That's stupidity. It's the same thing with all of these late night comedians. They write these one-liners meant to entrap somebody. It's not intelligent. It's not wise. It's not even fun to listen to. Okay, what we just had on this show, what we're having right now is conversation. It's something I specialize in. I'm a Renaissance man. In some regards, it's an old word, but it has meaning. If you have knowledge, if you've read a lot, if you've traveled a bit and you're a bit of a depressive as I am, it's very easy to do. I'll be right back.
Savage.
La Dolce Vita. This is Michael Savage. Those of you who are listening to this music know it was Nino Rota's music that I used the other night when I was describing a night in North Beach with some friends, old and new, eating outdoors on a hot night with the trolley car going by within a few feet of the table, and very much like Roma, and how much fun I had, and how you can never reproduce that moment. That's the bluebird of happiness landing on your palm. You try to hold on to it, you'll kill the bluebird. I learned that when I was 18 on a ship, by the way, from an older, wiser man who must have been 23 years old. I don't know how old he was. But you know, on those long sea trips, in those days it took 10 days to go from New York to Southampton, and it was basically an old troop ship. And at that point, it was being converted into a student ship. So it was cheap transportation. We crossed the Atlantic 10 days. We partied all night, basically staying drunk all night, and we slept all day. But in between the partying and the sleeping, we talked with each other, and you met a lot of interesting people. So I remember meeting this older guy. He was married, 22. His wife was a runaround. She was sleeping with half the guys on the ship. I felt bad for him. His name was Bill. I hope he's not listening to the show right now. She's probably on a walker somewhere with an oxygen tree somewhere in Boca Raton on a fifth husband, I would imagine. So he said to me, he was a nice guy, kind of a depressive. I could see why. So he says to me, well, he says, as you get older, you'll come to, I'm older. I'm 18. He was 22. He says, but the differential between 4 years in those days is like a phenomenal, right? So he says, well, he says, you know, the bluebird of happiness sometimes alights on your palm. And he said, let me give you one tip of advice. He said, never try to close your hand on that bluebird when it lands on your hand, because the minute you do, you'll break the legs of the bird and kill it. It was very true. And it's like that night in North Beach. If I went back there tonight, which I'm not going to do, impossible to recreate. The weather has changed to something I like better, which is foggy and cold. That's number one. Number two, the magic of that moment can never be reproduced exactly the same way. The magic wouldn't be there. It just wouldn't happen because my mood has changed. So you know what I'm saying? That's just the way it is. So you don't try to reproduce things. You take it as it comes. 1-800-449-8255, Reno, Nevada. Jay, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
I hope you're right about this next generation, Savage, but my reality that I see doesn't portray the kids don't seem to be, they seem worse than our generation. I'm 38. They don't seem like we have much promise. And the system they're going into is so...
Well, hold on. I didn't say this generation would suddenly go back to a more, a less lascivious, less libertine lifestyle. I didn't mean to imply that. Excuse me if you got that out. I said we're going to see it in about 15 years from a new generation of people who do not want to be sluts sleeping with everybody that walks down the street. And I think that everything goes in cycles, and I think we're going to go back to a new Victorian age in this country sooner than later, because there's a limit to how far people are willing to slum themselves, and right now it can't get any lower than what girls and boys have become. All a result of the Hollywood lifestyle, and frankly, Bill Clinton is the man who destroyed America's morality. It took one man to destroy this country's morality. It was him and Monica Lewinsky making oral sex, not sex, that destroyed an entire generation.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Mm-hmm.
angel. I can't make up my mind which one you are. I'd like to wake up and find.
Well, today on the Savage Nation, we've been asking these questions. What is the most bizarre conspiracy theory about Bin Laden that you've seen so far on the internet? And who do you think are more dangerous, Osama bin Laden deathers or 9/11 truthers? How do you think Obama will perpetuate his false heroics over the bin Laden assassination next week? Do you actually think Obama is encouraging conspiracy theories about the death of Osama bin Laden in order to distract Americans from his other military and economic failures? Will the Hitler of Iran be deposed within the next week by the mullahs? Do you think he'll be replaced by someone worse? Also, have you ever seen a U.S. president do such an extended victory lap of the kind Obama is doing this week? Do Obama's actions in reaction to the death of bin Laden make you feel proud or ashamed to be an American? What's the biggest mistake the Obama administration has made on this issue so far? Do you think that overexposure of this will actually backfire on Obama politically? I personally don't. I think the people are that stupid. As for the latest headlines, let's go to michaelsavage.com and other sites. Unemployment back up to 9%. Obama spiked the football, speaking to the SEALs, and congratulating himself really in front of them, using them as a stage prop. The streets of London swarming with radical Islamists, screaming, "Islam will dominate the world. They've not been kicked out. I'm not allowed into Britain." They should be thrown out, in my opinion. Gasoline is now eating 9% of household budgets. Average price sets record in Indiana, $4.25 a gallon. Paper is saying that April jobs went up 244,000, but how can the U.S. add jobs while the unemployment rate is going up? Well, funny money, huh? Senator is saying an executive order on bin Laden said, kill him, don't capture him. That's interesting. Tax promised by the Taliban. Historic Mississippi River floodwaters hit Memphis and force evacuation. Now the U.S. is launching drone attacks in Yemen, first in 10 years. What's next? Well, what's next? There's an awful lot next, so we'll go to my website and see what michaelsavage.com has on it. Al-Qaeda confirms bin Laden's death. Evidence at bin Laden's home raises nuclear concerns. He took the spotlight. 9/11 families angry over Obama's handling of bin Laden's death. Info at bin Laden compound shows Al-Qaeda mulled 9/11 train attack. State Department rejects citation of Pakistan for religious persecution. Hezbollah setting up operations near U.S. border. They say in Mexico, but don't believe it. Believe Department of Homeland Security. Will bin Laden's sea burial backfire? Bush wouldn't go to ground zero because he felt this was an Obama victory lap. Feds allow illegals to cross the border into America 14 times before giving them a felony charge. Libyan rebels are fearing Gaddafi is preparing to use mustard gas. Well, you want to know what sand dabs are. We have a picture of them from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Viagra is huge in Mexico. What's up with that? I'll read about it on Michael Savage. 10 ways Obama botched the aftermath of a masterful operation from the London Telegraph. A Muslim stalked his stepdaughter over four states before killing her because she was too Western. What else do we have for you? Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook bought a $7 million house. Okay. Bin Laden plotted the railroad terror. We told you about that. Obama honored the SEALs and others behind closed doors. The Madonna Kabbalah Center is being looked at by the IRS. Really? Madonna Kabbalah? Madonna Kadala? Kabbalah Kadana? Madonna Link Kabbalah Center in L.A. focus of IRS investigation. You're kidding me. Madonna's not an expert on Kabbalah? Oh, she's being picked on. Two charities linked to Madonna are also being scrutinized. The center has attracted A-list celebrities such as Ashton Kutcher and Gwyneth Paltrow. They all go to it. The Kabbalah Center, the Los Angeles-based spiritual organization that attempts to mingle ancient Jewish mysticism with the glamour of its celebrity devotees is the focus of a federal tax evasion investigation. Interesting. Those cooperating with the IRS include representatives of one of Madonna's charities, Raising Malawi. That's amazing. That's truly amazing. Little known. How do you like that? I don't want to read the whole article, but you ought to read this. It's a heck of a story. The Kabbalah Center. In a statement, the Kabbalah Center called the allegations in the suit meritless and said it intends to defend the case vigorously. That means they're guilty. Anytime you hear a defendant saying it's meritless and frivolous, they usually lose. Anyway, in a stinging February filing that referred to the Bergs as charlatans, I don't want to get into this. Okay, read the whole thing. It's on michaelsavage.com. The headline is, the Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles is the focus of an IRS investigation into tax evasion. All this and more on the Savage Nation. Lindsay Lohan to work as janitor, L.A. morgue. You know, I once worked at a morgue at Queens General Hospital. Did I ever tell you about that phase of my life? It lasted a very brief period of time, one day. Talk about what... Did I tell you this story? Did this ever come up, Beowulf, the morgue assistant? Do you remember this one? It did once. Shall I tell a morgue story now while we're waiting for calls? I graduate college. I go to Europe. I spend my time as a wastrel doing nothing with all the other bums I went to college to Europe's with, having a good time. I come back. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm trying to find myself. So I took the first job I could get, which was I think it was a janitor, actually, in the morgue at Queens General. To this day, I have nightmares about a red brick building with a huge smokestack that looked like, you know, Treblinka in Flushing, New York. Like walking up that hill, it was like walking up to Treblinka. I take a job as a mortuary assistant. I remember that was the title, because I had a degree in biology from Queens College. I was fit to be a mortuary assistant. It shows you what you have to do with your life to amount to anything. No one gives you anything. No one gives you anything. So I had to start as a mortuary assistant. So I go into the morgue. It was a pretty horrible situation. The chief pathologist had a cigar in his mouth, and he had just completed detaching the skull plate from a deceased woman. I will not identify her in any manner other than say a deceased woman. But her skull cap was not coming off readily, you see. So he put his foot up against the stainless steel table that her body was on, and he was pulling and snorting, and the ashes were falling into her face. I was astounded. So the pathologist assistants gave me a broom, a mop, and he said, just mop up around here, kid, and don't get in anyone's way. So then he snapped the skull cap off the woman and proceeded to excise her brain for the autopsy. That was A. Next case, two-year-old child, blue eyes, blonde hair, like a doll, dead, no one knew why, laying there on another table. Next one, white male, late 50s, laying there naked on the table. I won't describe something that I noticed, but apparently it's one of the reasons that a lot of women used to go to executions. I noticed that with my eagle eye. Well, I continued to mop up around the tables where the autopsies were conducted, and then at the end of the day, I submitted my resignation. So I can sympathize with Lindsay Lohan. 1-800-4 It's not made up. None of that. I really did that. I mean, say so. I quit the job and went on to something else. I think I went to work for the Department of Social Welfare. Today they call it something else. I was a welfare worker right after that. So all I could get. So I went from being a mortuary assistant to a welfare worker. Look, I've done a lot of, you know, blue collar stuff. This, that. It made me a different person than I am. I would normally be a happy person, but for all of those horrible jobs that I had. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
So, what do you want to talk about? I'll tell you what I'm going to talk about. I'm going into the bedrock of Western civilization again. I'm drilling down for another core bit, and I'm bringing it up. And here's what I have for you. It's from Jeremiah the prophet. And Jeremiah wrote this. The priest said not, where is the Lord? They said not, where is the Lord? And they that handle the law knew me not, said God. And the rulers trans- transgressed against me. The prophets also prophesied by Baal and walked after things that do not profit. So in other words, Jeremiah was writing what was going on in ancient Israel before the fall and collapse of ancient Israel. What do you think this is all about? What the hell do you think the whole Old Testament's about? It's about the fall of ancient Jerusalem because the Jews strayed from God. What do you want to tell you? I tell you it's all like a Mickey Mouse story, that it was all good and wonderful? The ancient olive growers were bad guys. They went off the track. They didn't listen to their prophets. They turned from God. They became degenerates. God got pissed off, and he therefore put them into bondage. And they were in bondage and in exile for thousands of years. Do you understand the story? Do you understand how harsh this is? Do you understand how harsh the prophecies of the Old Testament really are? Many of you don't even understand what it really is. It's a condemnation of the ancient Israelites. It's not something glowing and that they're all angels with some halos around them. It's all about, and I brought you into a land of fruitful fields to eat the fruit thereof and the good thereof, but you entered, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. Now, who's saying that? Well, Jeremiah is writing it. Who was Jeremiah? Jeremiah was just a man. I know the atheistic view of the Old Testament. Just a man, a kvetch, an old kvetch who didn't have a talk show. And so in those days, he wrote it down and had a scribe write it. He had hemorrhoids, bad breath. Things weren't going well for him, so he was fetching, unhappy. He was nothing. He wasn't a real prophet. Who was a real prophet? Who was a real prophet in those days? Why does this book survive thousands of years? Why? I'm asking you. Why did the Old Testament lead to the New Testament, and why did these books, these rocks of ages, why do they survive? Do you think that everyone who reads these books is a fool? You think no one who reads these is educated? Doesn't understand science? You think everybody who reads this is an unwashed, knuckle-dragging, throwback Neanderthal, as you would listen to the people on HBO? That's what they think? You think everybody is a fool but you? I don't think so. Let's go to West Virginia. Barry, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael. How are you doing? I was calling because I heard your story about Barack and Deborah.
Right.
And just wanted to add a little bit. Barack was actually a timid general, and he would not go into war until Deborah agreed to go with him.
Very interesting. So in this case, Deborah could be Hillary Clinton.
Hillary, or perhaps another country, waiting until France would go with him. Mm-hmm. But Barack he didn't want to go into war. He kind of held back. He was enjoying his life as a general, and he would only go when Deborah went, and Deborah said, that's fine, but if we go into war, I'll go with you, but you won't get the credit for it.
So I take it that you are a biblical a student of the Bible.
I try.
And what do you draw from the story of Deborah and Barack with regard to Barack Obama and the situation of today? Is there anything in that biblical prophecy that you think is relevant?
Well, I think it shows a point where leaders, for example, the general, where leaders are meant to lead and should stand out and to do their job and to lead in a way that's appropriate and in this case, lead in the way that the Lord intended for him to lead. And he refused to do that.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think it's a mark of a man who has disgraced the presidency to be traveling at a time like this? I don't know how else to put it. I think he's disgraced the office of the White House at this time with Japan, with Libya. How could the man come back and actually speak to the American people with a straight face?
I agree. And in the same case, the general, I think he's really abdicated his responsibility.
How could anybody refer to him as commander-in-chief with a straight face?
Well, being retired from the Army, it's tough. It would be tough.
Yep. Well, I appreciate you listening so carefully. Even here, a biblical reference I gave to Barack and Deborah from the Bible. I figure for those of you who read the Bible, the two listeners out of the 9 million who listen to the show, I think you'd enjoy it. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I know not: the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a young woman. Albany, New York. Chris, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi, Michael. On a quick personal note, I also had a black standard poodle named Teddy for 14 years. I lost him a few years ago.
God bless him. I hope he's in poodle heaven.
I pray he is, and I pray I meet him. I cannot tell you, and I'm sure you'll agree.
Well, you'll be his pet in the next world. Remember I told you there's somebody. I think it was John Steinbeck who wrote this. I could be mistaken. If I recall correctly, he said that the way it works is that in the next world, we are the pets of our pets, and they treat us the way we treated them.
Well, then he'll treat me good. That was the angel of my life.
And what did you? Is he going to feed you well, or he's got to watch your diet? So what else is on your mind?
Okay, I just wanted to say about Mr. Obama, he is the most unbelievable, arrogant, incompetent president we have ever had, and the American...
Well, when he raises up that head and looks down his nose, he reminds me of a foolish college teacher who's insecure.
And I fully believe the American people were scammed when he was elected.
Well, I fully believe. We all know it. I mean, we have most people, not me, I didn't vote for him. America has more voter remorse under this president than any president in history.
But I want to wish you the best.
No, you see, you heard of buyer's remorse, right? But Michael Savage determined that this is voter's remorse, so you could steal it tomorrow.
Savage.
Malou Innocent is a foreign policy analyst and columnist who has written about why America must recalibrate its policies following Bin Laden's assassination. Malou, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Well, obviously the war on terror is not over, but what's next?
I think it definitely narrow our objectives in Afghanistan and scale down our presence to something more narrow, something known as sort of a counterterrorism mission. We've relied, whether it's Osama bin Laden's death, whether it's the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Rimzi bin al-Shib, a lot of the greatest successes we've scored against al-Qaeda has been the result of counterterrorism operations, intelligence sharing with our partners overseas, and not necessarily large-scale, long-term occupations that we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, certainly with bin Laden's death, that doesn't mean the end of al-Qaeda, but it does allow us to sort of recalibrate our policies in a way that's more targeted and something that can actually sort of narrow not only our economic interests, but also our military interests in the region.
So bin Laden's death is symbolic, you think?
I think it is largely symbolic. I think it's symbolic for the United States and for al-Qaeda. I think that this delivers an enormous blow to al-Qaeda's morale, simply because bin Laden was really a figurehead. He was a mythical person within the organization. He definitely provided a great number of recruits to his cause, not just sort of inspirationally, but also in terms of funding and in terms of armaments, whether it was in the Philippines or the Balkans or in Pakistan, or in Kashmir. He definitely was a presence around the world. And he's also certainly sort of a morale boost for the United States. We've been at war against this sort of global al-Qaeda menace since 9/11, and having sort of bin Laden as dead now, that allows us to sort of move forward and have some closure. That being said, I think that overall, when it comes to targeting al-Qaeda, when you start taking out large numbers of their experienced leadership, you significantly damage the effectiveness of the organization. And that really speaks to the importance of what I mentioned earlier about counterterrorism and why those measures are really necessary when it comes to combating these jihadist networks. Again, it's sort of not necessarily something that we can nail down with large-scale troops, sort of the 100,000 that we see now in Afghanistan, but it definitely relies on our cooperation with partners overseas, and something that can definitely sort of advance our interests without expending thousands of lives in terms of U.S. military personnel and also the hundreds of billions of dollars that we've already spent.
What have we actually achieved with the 9 years in Afghanistan?
That's a fantastic question. Sadly, very little. It's unfortunate because I remember going to Afghanistan last year and just hearing story after story about how schools would be built with no teachers to staff them, how our government would pave roads and, you know, local Afghans would chip off the asphalt and use it for insulation for their homes. The problem is that we just don't have the local knowledge, and a lot of these projects end up falling through the cracks. And really, that's what we're doing now. It's nation building. It's not necessarily targeting al-Qaeda through sort of, you know, covert operatives or intelligence sharing. It's really a lot of sort of paving roads, building schools, mandating the number of women who can serve in the Afghan parliament. And really a lot of this overestimates our power to spread wealth and stability. And I think there's definitely an argument to be made that given our fiscal constraints at home, that money would better be spent here rather than abroad.
Do you agree with me that we should get out of Afghanistan now?
And I think so. I think we can definitely sort of scale down the mission. We can definitely begin withdrawing to a more reasonable level that would be necessary for counterterrorism. According to some estimates, that would be as little as 10 to 20,000 troops, not necessarily 100,000 troops. And even then, I mean, you see sort of CIA Director Leon Panetta saying that there are less than 100 al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan. And even if we were to create sort of this stable, non-corrupt electoral democracy, despite, you know, President Hamid Karzai and his corrupt regime, al-Qaeda can simply reposition its presence into other regions of the world, as we've seen. It used to have a presence in Germany and Spain and the United States. It also has a presence in Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan. So again, even if we were to create a stable electoral democracy in Afghanistan, that doesn't necessarily mean that it'll advance U.S. interests, and we may end up making ourselves weaker economically and militarily in the process.
What do you think will be perceived as weak if we leave Afghanistan as Russia did, even though Bin Laden is dead?
I think it cuts both ways. I think definitely that's a legitimate point to make. Certainly America will sort of be perceived as, oh, you know, we were weak in the response to sort of this jihadist threat. But that being said, we must control the narrative. If we already are sort of claiming defeat before we withdrawn, then we've already sort of lost the war. And I think we've sort of seen this with a lot of the protest movements after the Florida pastor Terry Jones burned a Quran. There's a great deal of animosity toward the foreign troop presence. That in and of itself is definitely weakening toward the mission. It weakens ourselves in the process. And also, I mean, we've seen that sort of the spread of militants to the north, west, and center of Afghanistan, which for years were the most stable areas. So that appears to make us weak as well. We have a corrupt and abusive central government under Hamid Karzai that can barely expand its authority beyond the major cities. That makes us appear weak. So I think it's sort of, again, it cuts both ways. I mean, the longer we stay and the more we invest, the more we appear weak. But at the same time, I think we must understand that al-Qaeda will sort of, they'll sort of tweak the narrative as much as they want, so we might as well do what's best for U.S. interests, and that would require us to scale down to a counterterrorism operation.
With the revelation of Bin Laden hiding in Pakistan, sort of in plain sight, will this destabilize the Pakistani government?
It's interesting. I think that Pakistan, at least some elements within the military or intelligence apparatus, must have known about bin Laden's whereabouts, simply because they do assist various insurgent groups that are commanding the war in Afghanistan and the insurgency in Afghanistan. So I find it highly unlikely that no one in the intelligence apparatus knew about bin Laden. That being said, Pakistan is an interesting dynamic, simply because if they had gone after bin Laden themselves, I think it would have been even more destabilizing to Pakistan, and I say this for a very important reason. It's not so much that Pakistanis are sympathetic to bin Laden or sympathetic to al-Qaeda. It's that many Muslims around the world believe that American foreign policy is an attack on their faith. And even if we don't want to accept that, that's just their reality. I mean, I remember going to the region and hearing this ad nauseum, and it was almost myself very nauseating, but that's sort of the reality we must confront, and that bin Laden definitely had a message that resonated in this part of the world. And so on the one hand, you know, Pakistan has been very unhelpful at times, but they've also been very helpful in other times. I think the way we sort of decrease our dependence on them is to, again, scale down our mission in Afghanistan, because we rely on them so heavily for operations there. And unfortunately, we've been being bent over a barrel because we depend on Pakistan so much.
Well, where do we stand with Pakistan now?
Well, right now it seems as if the administration, and just judging from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's comments, that nothing will change. You know, you hear lawmakers on the Hill saying that we should re-examine USAID to Pakistan, which we should, but it seems as if the administration is reluctant to do that. Again, we rely on them for upwards of between at least, according to some estimates, 40 to 60% of the provisions that go into Afghanistan sneak through Pakistani territory. As we saw last year and just recently, a couple weeks ago, Pakistan stopped the border. They closed the border to allow those provisions to go through. So that's a great deal of dependence that we have on them. So the only way we can really increase our leverage is to put greater scrutiny on the aid we give to Pakistan, and apply more pressure to them in terms of counterterrorism. But again, we can rely on them with counterterrorism, but not with Afghanistan. And the longer we remain in Afghanistan, the more we remain sort of susceptible to Pakistani interests and how much they've sort of assisted the various groups that destabilize Afghanistan.
Well, is the solution to defeating al-Qaeda these precision strikes instead of an overwhelming force such as we first used in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I think definitely that would be the direction we must go in, as sort of these narrow counterterrorism measures rather than sort of the heavy-booted military presence. And I think, you know, our men and women in uniform have fought valiantly. They've fought bravely. And I think the best thing going forward is to rely on measures that don't put them in harm's way, especially when we're, again, sort of backing what is a very abusive and corrupt central government in Kabul. Hamid Karzai is not worth one more American life. And the sooner we recognize that, the sooner we can get out of Afghanistan.
If we finish our mission against the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, what prevents the Taliban from reassembling?
I think that there's very little to prevent the Taliban from reasserting, say, its presence in the southern and eastern portions of Afghanistan. It definitely has a presence there. It will continue to have a presence there simply because, you know, they provide rudimentary justice, basic policing services, basic services that the Kabul government can barely provide on its own. And I think that when we look at how much we've already poured into this mission, how much we poured into nation building, it's clear that the Taliban, and this is sort of just, these aren't, you know, this sort of grand movement that wants to establish a global caliphate. These are bigoted local mullahs. They're an indigenous Pashtun movement. This is something that we can't really be eradicated. They would be on the equivalent of genocide if we try to do that, and we just don't have the manpower or the research to do that. Luckily, the Taliban has a very limited regional focus. It wants to reassert its presence in this region. And as we've seen from the sort of the militants that sort of wage its operations in this region, they can be contained sort of to these southern and eastern areas and not necessarily be a force that will come back and attack us here. I think with the death of bin Laden, again, this was a major blow to the al-Qaeda network. They've seen that America can strike when necessary, when capable, and whenever there is a threat that rises its head, we will be able to strike, and we'll be able to strike unrelentingly. I think they've learn that lesson, but I don't think we can really sort of dupe ourselves or sort of convince ourselves that we can eradicate the Taliban from this region. I think that'll be an impossible mission, and in fact, we would be there in perpetuity.
Well, the mission turned from defeating al-Qaeda to nation building in Afghanistan. I don't think we've accomplished either.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that we have been able to significantly diminish al-Qaeda's ability to attack the United States again. That's been thanks to, again, our counterterrorism operations that we have around the world, and also the enhanced sort of domestic surveillance and domestic measures that we've put in place. Certainly, some would argue that those are intrusive, but there are certain measures that have been very effective. In terms of nation building, unfortunately, the mission creep that we've seen over the past 10 years, it's enhanced certain measures of Afghan life, and, you know, more women can go to medical clinics, more children are in school, but in terms of creating a fully functioning and capable, self-sustaining government that'll last in the long term, we haven't been able to achieve that. And honestly, very few countries have been able to achieve that in Afghanistan, whether you're talking about the British or the Russians or the Americans and the sort of global coalition that we have in Afghanistan. The fact that 42-plus nations can't create a sustainable government after 10 years shows the futility of that mission.
Malou, thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Oh, great for having me, Michael. Thank you so much.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
This is the Savage Nation. Now, as far as Pakistan goes, there's no question they were hiding him. They didn't miss the hideaway. They knew he was there. He was living on a compound protected by the Pakistani military. It's where the retired Pakistani generals live, for God's sakes. You know? So, we don't know what's coming tomorrow. We can celebrate today and tomorrow have a tragedy on our hands. So what are we going to do with Pakistan now? They're a nuclear power. They're fundamentally playing both sides against the middle to get our, not only to get our billions of dollars in aid that we're sending them and our weaponry, but they're harboring, they hear where they were harboring him. Where's the Wahiri is there too? Who else is there? Who else is in that so-called compound? I'm shocked by the way the pictures that are coming out of the war room that Biden was awake and looked actually like he was half awake and paying attention. You know, when you look at the pictures that are showing up, in the war room, were they watching it in real time? It looks like in a movie. You mean some of the SEALs had it on their helmets, like a video camera of the shootout? Unbelievable. You know that I have a solution. I don't mean to become comedic in the political arena, but I can't help it at times. I have a solution to straighten out the budget mess. And I think we could wipe out the deficit if the Obama administration were to release the videotape of the shootout and the burial at sea and do a pay-per-view. The government could wipe out the national debt. Release it worldwide. $39.99. It would be bigger than any WWF, any cage fight, any boxing match, Pacquiao, you name it. $39.99. They could wipe out the national debt with that one. Okay? Incidentally, yesterday I had a caller from a man who said that he was an Orthodox Jewish man. And he said to me, you should not rejoice when your enemy falls. I said, no, you're wrong. I said, you're 100% wrong. He said, but that's what the boys in the yeshiva are learning. That you shouldn't rejoice when your enemy falls. I said, hey, look. I said, why don't you stop with this hogwash? I said, you're wrong. I said, maybe if instead of going to Israel and just sitting there and praying, you were forced to join the military, maybe you'd also rejoice when your enemy fell. So I got an email now from a rabbi. Before you shoot your mouth off and send a letter to the ADL about me, this just came to me. As a rabbi in Jerusalem, originally from Santa Monica, he said, I just want to tell you that what you said about rejoicing when one's enemy falls is exactly right. Savage, the Talmud is clear that it is proper to rejoice when one's enemy falls in battle. And it's from the Babylonian Talmud, Megillah 16a, and he qualifies the verse in Proverbs 24, which says, quote, when your enemy falls, do not rejoice. But that means a person of your own nation who is your enemy, but not when that person is a foreigner out to destroy your people. He then goes on and says, I think that we all understand on a gut level that when a fellow American commits a crime and is put to death, we are faced with a national failure in a way for our nation was responsible for producing that person, and therefore rejoicing is less appropriate. But Savage, you deserve to know that your thoughts are reflected in the Talmud and that the wise men several thousand years ago agreed with you. Thanks for being a voice of reason. That really was it came out of the blue because I was sure when I saw from a rabbi he was going to attack me. The word rabbi only means teacher. That's all it means. It doesn't mean, what does the word teacher mean in America? It can mean inspired, it can mean insipid. It's the same with holy men. How could an imam call himself a holy man as this, the head of the imam from the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem came out and said, the killing of a lion. Anything like that? Not in my country it wouldn't be. What would happen if a priest got up and started calling for death and killing? Or a rabbi got up in a synagogue, death and killing, or a Buddhist monk, death and killing? The FBI would have microphones in their bowels. The FBI would have a microphone in their cereal bowl in the morning. But if an imam gets up and starts calling for the death of the president, what is this country? What is this world that we're putting up with this rubbish? To me, a religion teaches peace, or it's not a religion worth anything. If it is a religion, it teaches how to get along with your neighbor, and it teaches peace. Otherwise, it's not a religion. It's a political warfare machine disguised in a robe. And I'm not alone in my viewpoint. I'm sick of this. Las Vegas, Chris, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I just wanted to tell you I was reading Trickle of Poverty in the workplace where I work. I was on break, and a couple of my friends asked me what I was reading. And when I showed them the cover of the book, they're like, what is that, the American version of Mein Kampf? I'm like, whoa. I said, do you even know what this guy stands for? Do you know what he says? He goes, all I know is that he's a hate monger, and I refuse to listen or hear anything he says. I'm like, well, then your opinion is ridiculous. I said, he goes, well, I know he hates gay people. I said, okay, there you go. You're wrong right there. He's a sexual libertarian. He doesn't care who you sleep with. He just wants you to leave marriage alone. I go,
that's 100% right. So what, were these gay people?
No, they were just, I work with a lot of different types of people from all over the world. You know, I don't want to say where I work because, you know, I'd rather not.
Yeah, well, I guess the cover of the book says Trickle Up Poverty, Stopping Obama's Attack on Our Borders, Economy, and Security. I believe Obama's the hate monger. He's attacking our borders by letting illegal aliens flood into the country, including drug dealers and drug murderers. He's attacked our economy, and he's attacked our security. I mean, it's common sense that I'm right. If that makes me a hate monger, then join the club.
I asked them, I go, what has he ever said that was hateful? They couldn't answer me. They don't know what you believe.
Well, you see, this is what you have when you have prejudice. What you encountered here was the face, the ugly face of bigotry. These are bigots in plain English. You know what the word prejudice means, Chris? You ought to take this back to work. You can say it to them calmly. Say, you know, I'm offended by what you said. You wouldn't read the book. You wouldn't look at the book. And yet you came in and you said he's this and he's that. But, you know, you have committed prejudice, the very thing you say you're not interested in doing. And they say, we're not prejudiced. The word prejudice means to prejudge. Are you aware of that, Chris?
Absolutely.
All right, so they're prejudiced men. What do you expect from them?
I even asked them. I said, look, I will lend you the book when I'm done. They're like, I said, just read 40, 50 pages of it. He goes, no, I won't read that. I'm like, well, then you have no argument. What are you arguing?
Ask them if they read the Quran after the 9/11 attacks. I know foolish liberal lawyers who went out and bought a Quran. I swear to God, after 9/11, I said, what the hell are you doing that for? They said, so we can better understand Islam. I swear to you.
Sure. Sure. It's unbelievable what's going on. It's just the stupidity. It's crazy.
Tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you another copy of Trickle Up Poverty so you can give it to one of your good prejudiced friends. Stay on the line, okay?
Savage.